Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Life is a workout, and Smoothie King is here to help you power through. Whether you're grinding out bicep curls or muscling the couch across the living room, crushing morning miles, or sprinting through back-to-back meetings, Smoothie King has fuel to help you maximize your workouts, own your recovery, and elevate your game. Give your body the energy, protein, and power it needs with a lineup of delicious smoothies made to help you conquer your goals. Only at Smoothie King.
Hey, pull up a chair. It's Hacks on Tap with David Axelrod, Robert Gibbs, and Mike Murphy.
Could Biden break the historical pattern of the, you know, midterms going badly?
Absolutely. But we could hold both of these houses. But we have to say the right things. And we have to note the Republicans always close well. Why? Because they find some new way to scare the living daylights out of swing voters about something. That's what they did in 2021, where they made critical race theory sound worse than smallpox. And it wasn't being taught in any public schools in America, but they didn't care. They just scare people.
So there you go. There's a familiar voice from the past there, Mike Murphy.
A shrewd political strategist who recognizes that the R's do close well. Although yeah. That scare voter stuff, I still remember, as you probably do, being Jurassic like me, those old Democratic ads with the scissors cutting the Social Security card in half. So we're table that part of President Clinton's analysis. But I think he's essentially right.
We shouldn't table it because I think that there's some strength to it. But there's nobody better to mull over the midterms and the politics of this moment than Mo Alethi, the distinguished director of the Institute of Politics at Georgetown University and the former communications director for the Democratic National Committee. Mo, it's good to be with you, brother.
I'm thrilled and honored to be here. I was joking with Murphy earlier, like I've been wondering what a guy has to do to get invited to be on this esteemed program.
Well, so. we call it the Chicago way, Mo. You're just a little envelope.
Yes, thank you. Murphy and I divided it up and the invitation went out.
By the way, I have to say, this is, you might have to Google it, a few listeners. Hoya Saxa, my friend. We are Hoya both Saxa. SFSers.
That's exactly right. That's
yeah.
exactly
You're right. You actually graduated. I'm still on a leave of absence. I got suckered into a congressional campaign.
Back.
And I got to do a Chicago way deal with the school there and trying to get the parchment worked out. But anyway, great to have you here.
Until they put Murphy on the basketball team, he refuses to come back.
Damn right.
So, well, just the way
well,
it
we
is.
Might need the help. We might need the help.
Yeah. No, I'd be an improvement, which says everything.
Let's just pick up where Bill Clinton left off. And you're right, probably the shrewdest political mind who's been in the White House in our lifetime. I mean, he's very, very savvy on politics. You do see, Mike, these midterms. It feels like, and you look at polling, it feels like the summer of exultance on the part of Democrats who thought they were absolutely dead is now, you know, there are some gravitational forces at play here.
Yeah, totally. I'll just, you know, and we talk about this a little bit on the Hacks on Tap newsletter. I also did our friend Dan Senor's podcast about it because there, you know, a lot of people try to use this polling as a therapy animal. Oh, thank God we're going to win now. I can relax. It's August 28th. And it's not nearly that predictive. It's a great tool to know where public opinion is now, and it gives you hints to where it may be going. But we went through this deal where the polling was so bad, the Dems all got demoralized. Then you had kind of a confirmation bubble. We're back. It's over. We're going to be fine. And now, as you put it, the gravity of a midterm where historically the party in power loses double-digit seats in the House, We have huge inflation. You can argue maybe it's ameliorating a little, but fundamentally, that historically has been very bad for the party in power. And we got a big wrong track election. So the Dems have opportunities based on Republican clown shoe behavior, but fundamentally, it's kind of reverting to mean as the election gets closer for an off year. And so the Repubs are having a bit of a comeback in the conventional wisdom now, which is so easy to hustle with polling data, to get back to my main point.
But Murphy doesn't want to talk about this, but there is something to what Clinton said about the Republican discipline and kind of they hunker down on some issues that are meant to, yes, inflame their base and excite their base, but also to try and win over independent voters. And we see crime ads surfacing everywhere. We're going to talk about that in a little bit. But also, we see this big effort on the part of Governor DeSantis in Florida, the governor of Texas, to put immigration on the agenda. And last week, DeSantis sent 50. We can discuss whether it was, we've heard the term kidnapping. That seems harsh, although the sheriff down there in San Antonio is opening an investigation about how they were spirited away. But he flew 50 asylum seekers from Venezuela to Martha's Vineyard as part of a stunt to put greater attention on the immigration. Is it effective?
I think it could be. I mean, look, the Republicans have done a good job historically of tapping into emotional issues that mobilize their base and can oftentimes frighten swing voters. They seem to be leaning into that right now after sort of their early messaging strategy started to, I think, I'm not going to say hit a brick wall, but wasn't getting the same traction now that it was earlier in the cycle. So they're diving into that. And one of the reasons why, I think, is because Democrats are doing the same. Democrats have, ever since the Supreme Court decision on abortion came down, have made that a central focus of their campaign in order to mobilize the Democratic base and scare some swing voters. So, you know, it's really fascinating to watch. 6 months ago, we were saying this was going to be all about inflation. But right now, the campaign, as it's shaping up today, and there's still, you know, at least three eternities between now and the end of voting, but at least the way it's shaping up today is that cultural issues are really proving to be dominant in both parties. And I guess part of this is going to be trying to figure out which one just has more resonance at the end of the day.
Yeah, I think the scary monster playbook is built into both parties. They just have different scary monsters. And, you know, the weird thing about the Republicans is they provided one scary orange monster to the Democrats for free, who's been a pretty effective election tool for them over the last couple of cycles. But this crime thing, you know, the Republicans don't have geniuses to figure this out. You don't have to be a genius. The Democratic left went on a big defund the police bender. There is highly visible crime. You can argue crime statistics versus crime perception, but the perception is crime is increasing. So the Republicans are set up perfectly to say, yeah, they're crazy. They're for defending. They hate the cops. We're pro-cop. And they're running that play, and it's working in some places. Politics 101.
I don't want to leave immigration, but let's just on the crime point, there's a very specific target here, which are these suburban voters who are the swing voters in most elections these days, and certainly in the swing House and Senate districts this year. Those voters have been impacted by the Dobbs decision, I think a little bit put off by Trump's antics, repelled by some of Trump's choices. But this is an issue that has some power out in the suburbs. And clearly that is what Republicans have in mind. But before we leave the immigration thing, Murphy, I want to talk about DeSantis because he's got an interesting, both he and Abbott in Texas are up this year. But he even more than Abbott seems to be running two campaigns at once. He's running a general election campaign in Florida, which he seems pretty comfortable about. And then he's running a primary campaign for 2024. It seems to me that this is as much aimed in his own for his own personal politics at 2024, because there's a big Venezuelan or a sizable Venezuelan population in Florida. And this wasn't exactly a popular tactic with them, was it?
Well, it's fascinating because he is running a primary campaign now. That's the dominant campaign in his life. The governor's reelection campaign is just little elevator music unless he gets in trouble with Charlie Crist.
Unless the elevator gets stuck.
Yeah, exactly. And it might. I think in this year DeSantis will win, but I think Crist is a highly capable, if somewhat flexible politician, and we'll see what happens there. But look, I'm from the Republican Party where refugees from communism were embraced, not turned into props, hustled, and maybe, I want to see what the Bexar County Sheriff comes up with, but there's some, at least allegations, that they were kind of misled and hustled into being a big stupid photo op to get a few Fox News hits. I think even in his Republican base world, these tactics are a little too clever by half, and he opens himself up for a pretty big counterattack. We are on the side, we conservatives, of Venezuelan refugees. So we'll see. But in his domestic politics, he's showing kind of a cavalier attitude about that, you know, the data showing a 4 or 5 point race doesn't really back up. We'll see if Chris can take advantage of it.
Yeah. Mo, what do you think about DeSantis as, you know, not the overall tactic, because I kind of agree with you that it, you know, Republicans want to, their basic message is they'd love to talk about crime, immigration, inflation, and Biden and lay it all at Biden's feet. And there is a problem at the border. Democrats make a mistake when they say the border is secure, as the vice president did. People know that there's a problem at the border. It's been there for years. It hasn't been ameliorated. So I agree with you that that's a good tactic. What do you think this does for DeSantis?
I mean, the interesting thing about Ron DeSantis, you know, look, first of all, everyone says he's the front runner if were it not for Trump, right, in 2024, and may actually be the one guy that could play Trump's game and go toe to toe with him. We're all old enough to remember that at this point in 2008, Rudy Giuliani was that guy, and right in 20. We can go through the people who are in 2016, Jeb Bush was that guy at this point in the cycle.
Ouch. Don't mention that.
Yeah. No. We'll have to see. Yeah. Sorry. We'll have to see.
I'm recovered now.
How he is as a candidate once the campaign actually gets going. But the thing I find really interesting about DeSantis as a potential candidate is, look, he is trying to claim the MAGA mantle. And he's one of the few candidates who are doing it without having to rely on pushing the big lie about the 2020 election. You look at all these Senate candidates around the country that Trump endorsed, in large part because they bought into and they pushed the lie about the 2020 election. They're still talking about it. I mean, it's the greatest gift the Democratic Party has right now is that so many of these Republican candidates are not talking about immigration. They're not talking about crime. They're still talking about the 2020 election. Right. DeSantis is kind of going a different route. And we'll see if he's successful, but it's an interesting theory, right? That can he be the MAGA guy by tapping into other, you know, other arguments rather than just placating Donald Trump's ego?
He's a culture vulture. Any cultural issue he can leap into, he does.
But the other thing, just to, let me interject for a sec, on DeSantis, what the DeSantis science experiment proves now, because who knows who's going to win the primaries, but it shows that Trump is weak enough in Republican world that there's room for somebody big and serious to go out there and maneuver against him and not immediately get shut out of the party. You know, the very fact there's an opening for DeSantis to do what he's doing shows that a significant chunk of the Republican electorate isn't anti-Trump, but they want to move on to somebody new and fresh and not as backward looking.
Listen, I kind of think, you know, I say more about this later. I had Adam Kinzinger on my Axe Files podcast this week, and he said, look, I don't think DeSantis is going to run against Trump. He said, I think if Trump runs, Trump's going to be the nominee. And he said, and DeSantis is going to say, hey, I can run in 4 years or 8 years, but he's there in case Trump doesn't run, and as a plausible legatee of Trump's, you know, whole act. But to your point, Mo, he's actually been pretty clever about about how he approaches these election issues, for example. Like he doesn't dwell on 2020, but he created an election law police force in Florida. So he'll go to a MAGA crowd and he'll say, "We're already, you know, our police are out there. We're going to crack down on the fraud." And so he, you know, he tickles the bone or he tickles whatever. And they respond to that. What about the crime issue, Mo? And how powerful a tool is that? That's traditionally been a strong tool for Republicans. Murphy points out Democrats, and very few, by the way, but there were voices enough on the left on defund police. No, I actually think it was relatively few.
Mm-hmm. But no, my point is enough to let it become a thing. It's totally a thing here in L.A. It's a progressive city, so we have plenty of local Democrats who are proudly defund the cops, and therefore it gets into the, you know, into the debate, and it becomes a thing, and the Republicans gleefully out in the suburbs bounce off it.
Yeah, I honestly don't know. I don't know, although there's a policing bill that's held up in the House by the left because I think it does commit more to police, and they probably should pass that bill.
Well, and Murphy, the thing though is, in a lot of these House races, Republicans are probably bouncing off of it, but so are a lot of Democratic candidates.
Yeah, they're trying to triangulate their way out of the trouble.
And it's not even triangulating. I mean, to Axe's point, a lot of these, it is not the mainstream position within the Democratic Party amongst its voters or even amongst the majority of its candidates. And so there are a lot of districts out there where you've got, you know, swing districts where you've got Democratic candidates saying, "I never was for defund the police.
Right, right.
I am not for defund the police." And that's actually helping them position themselves as independent voices in some way. So I'm not sure it is the surefire winner for Republicans in a lot of these districts that they think they are. It's giving opportunities to Democrats.
One of the interesting tactics, Mike, that some Democratic candidates are using are attacking Republicans for voting against the Rescue Act, which had funding for
cop
police
money in it.
Within it. Yeah.
But still, if we step back, if the election is a debate on Biden economics, which in the latest NBC poll, his disapproval on the cost of living is in the 60s, on handling the economy, it's in the high 50s, higher than his overall disapproval, and it's about crime, and it's about the border, that's a Republican election. Even if the Democrats are shrewdly tactically saying, "Wait a minute, I'm not for defend the cops,"
right,
it's being fought on Republican advantage territory.
So why aren't Republicans running on that? Because it seems to me, watching this cycle play out, that the Democrats have an opportunity. I'm not sure they're fully capitalizing on it, right? But with all this other noise, whether we're talking about the DeSantis stunt with the shipping of the migrants, or whether you're talking about Lindsey Graham introducing a ban on abortion, or whether you're talking about any number of Republican candidates who are talking about the 2020 election, they're talking about at local level, talking about banning books in libraries. It seems like Democrats have an opportunity here to actually lean in and say, "You know what? Here's the difference. Yeah, the cost of gas and milk is too high. We're at least trying to deal with that." What are they doing? They're trying to ban abortion. They're playing politics with people's lives. They're banning books in school libraries.
Yeah, that's the general election offense. I totally agree tactically they ought to be doing more of it. The Republicans, remember, it's a two-headed deal. In the primary, it's all the crazy stuff. The minute they get to a general election, it's fire the Democrat, Biden, inflation and crime and the border. So,
but they're not doing that. They're not doing that in a lot of races.
Well, no. If you look at the paid media, they are. It gets muddled up because they tend to treat general elections like Republican primaries, like DeSantis is doing, which is not advantageous in a tough general. But I do believe they're in the middle of the big pivot from it to the ones that are sane about it, which is hopefully 2/3 into general election argument. Most of the paid advertising is crime and border stuff right now, some inflation and cost of goods.
And there's a huge investment. I mean, this is what's turning the race. And I mean, Ohio should be a Republican state. That's what's beginning to turn the race in Ohio. Just tons of Republican money poured in behind those issues.
Right. We're seeing it in Wisconsin too, where you know, the Democrats starting to stop. Yeah.
New poll today in Wisconsin, a dead heat, basically. I think Barnes, the Democrat, is up 49-48. There's always been this question. He's very progressive, African-American candidate from Milwaukee. How does a state like Wisconsin, which is so evenly divided, in a year like this, respond? You know, now Johnson's the incumbent, unpopular, but he was unpopular in the past, and he's navigated his way through these rocky shoals. So Wisconsin's a race that Democrats hope to make pick up a seat. It's very, I think, it's dicey right
now.
Yeah,
well, what the Johnson people would tell you, and I'm an old Wisconsin guy, did Governor Thompson's reelect, is they were dying in the primary because there were multiple Democratic candidates for somebody that could make the race not about them. Because Johnson has bad numbers. And with the progressive level with Mandela Barnes, they do have something to work with now that a more Teflon candidate wouldn't have given them. So, you know, that's made that in an already competitive state even a trickier race for the D's. And, you know, Johnson is vulnerable. So that's why it's like 2 points in most of the polling.
It is a razor tight race. So we'll see what happens there. Georgia is a race that, you know, Democrats were very high on in the summer. A lot of fun being made of Herschel Walker, the former football great who was stumbling all over himself on the campaign trail.
Chinese clouds. Yeah, exactly.
But that race is, there are a couple of polls out this morning, you guys. Yeah. Atlanta Journal-Constitution has Walker up by two. Another poll has Warnock up by two, both under 40. This one could go to a runoff again. Georgia could end up being once again in a position to decide who controls the U.S. Senate. But I wanted to play a little bite. You know, Walker's been avoiding debates with Warnock, who, of course, is the pastor of the Ebenezer Baptist Church and is a great presenter. And he's finally agreed to a debate in front of a crowd in Savannah. And he was asked about preparing for the debate, and this is what he said.
You told me I got to prepare, so I'm preparing. I'm this country boy. You know, I'm not that smart. And he's that preacher. He's a smart man, wear these nice suits. So he's going to show up and embarrass me at the debate October the 14th. And I'm just waiting. You know, I'll show up, and I'm going to do my best. I'm going to do my best.
You know, very, very shrewd. Because he's managed to just clobber expectations and revert to his persona of just one of us. So I think that was pretty shrewd, David. What do you think? And then I want to call back a memory that it makes me think of.
There were a bunch of commentators who said, wow, he's saying he's not smart and the other guy's smart and everything. I think this was sort of a brilliant stroke, because it wasn't just that he was lowering expectations for the debate, but he really jumped into the cultural cleavage, you know, and he sort of struck a blow against the smarty pants, you know, liberal elites who look down their nose at, you know, working class voters and so on. I mean, that's really isn't that the underpinning of his message?
Oh, 100%. And you're right. He killed two birds with one stone there, right? Like the expectations game. I always hate when campaign staff go out there and talk about how great of a debater their candidate is, and because they rarely live up to those expectations, right? So he's managing the expectations thing. But look, I'm a firm believer that the single greatest cleavage in our politics today is not left versus right. It is the streets versus the elites, right? Mm-hmm. The front versus the back. And you've got very good candidates in both parties who recognize that, and a lot of candidates who don't. Walker, for all of his flaws, gets that and keeps tapping into that and propping Warnock up as a tool of the elites, if not an elitist himself. Now, I think Warnock is a much stronger candidate than a lot of people give him credit for being.
Oh, I think he is,
Which is why this race is so close, given the politics of Georgia and the political environment. It shouldn't be that close. But for all of his flaws, that's one thing Walker keeps coming back to, and I think it does serve him well.
Yeah, totally, particularly in a wrong track year like this. And, you know, it's funny. I, hearing that, because this is the first shrewd move we've really seen out of the Herschel Walker campaign, I was reminded of the old Saturday Night Live sketch during the Reagan era with the brilliant Phil Hartman playing Reagan, being his doddering self in front of the press, and then the reporter leaves and he's a strategic genius. We went to the Wayback Archives. Let's listen to a minute of that.
And finally, Mr. President, about the Iran-Nicaraguan connection, some may wonder which was worse, your knowing or your not knowing.
Well, all I can say is I didn't know. And, well, we're trying to find out what happened because none of us know.
Well, thank you, Mr. President.
Well, I hope I've answered your questions as best I could, given the very little that I know. Goodbye and God bless you.
Thank you, Mr. President.
Thank you very much. Okay, get back in here. All right, let's get down to business. I'm only going to go through this once, so it's essential that you pay attention. One, Casey.
Yes, sir.
You'll spearhead our new operation to fund the Contras. The C-5As with the tow missiles and grenade launchers will leave for South Africa at 08.
So maybe it's, you know, who knows who this Senator Walker may turn out to be?
Yeah, I'm not sure that Herschel Walker's having those kinds of meetings behind closed doors, but it's a great bit. Before we leave Senate, Murphy, you wanted to talk about Nevada, which I think is also one of the races that's going to determine control of the Senate.
Nevada is so interesting. And of all these mega races, it gets the least press attention. There aren't a lot of public polls there. You know, it's not right on top of the East Coast like a Pennsylvania race or even Georgia. So the Democratic senator, Catherine
Cortez Masto,
has been in kind of generic senator in trouble for a while. So Adam Laxalt gets nominated. And the Dems went right to the abortion issue, trying to capture all that energy. Shrewd move by the classic playbook. Nevada being one of the most pro-choice states. It's about as pro-choice as California is. But he's hung in there in the polling. And he's done an interesting thing. He's tried to, and it's kind of an echo what Lindsey Graham's bill was about. He's tried to kind of pivot an attack. He's got an op-ed. We have it in the Hacks on Tap newsletter, which is an interesting case study, and it'll be fascinating to see if it works. His argument is Nevada has already constitutionally, with a voter initiative, protected abortion rights, so nothing's going to change. And my opponent, you know, Senator Cortez Masto, is a wild-eyed liberal, late-term abortions, all kinds of unpopular stuff on the other side. And we'll see if that can get him out of what ought to be a really tough environment on Roe. So far, you know, a point or two ahead or behind in the polling, and that one could be the pivot race. It's right up there with Georgia and Pennsylvania in importance and Wisconsin. Yeah.
I don't know, Mo. I don't know what you think. I mean, I don't know if I'd want to fight it out on those grounds if I were Laxalt. I don't know that he's going to win that battle.
But he's got offense. But go ahead, Mo.
Yeah, fine. It's offense. But if I were him, I'd play offense somewhere entirely different, right? There are possibly no other state whose economy is as impacted by inflation as Nevada, right? Like that entire state's economy, the hospitality, gaming industry, entertainment industry, when there's high cost of living, they feel it in a way that a lot of other places elevated level than over a lot of other places. If I were him, there's nothing else I would be talking about. Every word that is focused on the issue of abortion rather than that is a missed opportunity for him. He may have offense, but the underlying argument is going to benefit her. And I will say this. There's maybe no state other than Georgia that sort of my generic Democratic operative Senate watcher friends are worried about than Nevada, but it is also one where they look at the quality of the candidate and think we are still hanging in there. One of the things I keep hearing is that you will not find a harder working candidate running for the United States Senate than Catherine Cortez Masto, that she's very good on the stump, that she's very good at the mechanics of campaigning, and that she is working harder than almost any other incumbent. So, look, I think that one is, I'm with you, Mike. It's going to be one of the two or three pivotal races that will tell the tale of the night. But I think Laxalt is actually missing more opportunities than he's seizing right now.
The problem, Mo, as you know, in Nevada is it's such a transient state that it's hard for incumbents to develop a relationship with voters that in a way that you can in other states. But listen, I think those three states that we've discussed, Wisconsin, Georgia, and Nevada, and Pennsylvania, where the Lieutenant Governor John Fetterman is running against Dr. Oz, those four states are going to determine, I believe, control of the United States Senate in 2022.
I agree.
And I wouldn't stop keeping an eye on Ohio. I was just in Ohio over the weekend talking to a lot of people who are sort of your mainstream Republicans who think that Ryan might have that he was the perfect Democratic nominee for that state in this year. And they think that there's going to be a few, seesaw is going to go up and down a few more times before the dust settles there.
He's running a great campaign, but boy, Ohio is hard in a year like this. I'll throw one more. Sure. And I'm talking my book here a little because he's my friend and I'm helping his super PAC. But keep an eye on Utah. That's a tied race right now. And that incumbent, Mike Lee, is in trouble. And Evan McMullen is not the Washington General's Democrat candidate who's always destined to lose there. He's made it very competitive.
He's not a Democrat candidate at all, which makes this race interesting. He's a conservative. He's an independent. And the Democrats have not decided not to field a candidate there. So that gives him an open shot at to form a kind of center-left, center-right coalition.
Right, and right now the polling is basically tied 47-46. He's got that coalition. The question is, will the McConnell cavalry come in and bury him? Because he's made it clear he will not caucus with Schumer or McConnell. So the Dems are taking kind of a bemused look, but not a lot of financial support. Though the Democratic voters there tend to be much more anti-Lee and interested in McMullen.
On Mo's point, I don't want to shortchange Tim Ryan. I think he's probably running the best race of any Democratic candidate in the country in terms of understanding his state, speaking to the working class voters in his state, keeping his opponent on defense. And by the way, someone else who put his opponent on defense today is his opponent's main sponsor, Donald Trump, who was in Ohio over the weekend. And this is what he had to say about his candidate for the Senate, J.D. Vance.
The New York Times did a fake story today, big front page, that J.D. wasn't sure if he wanted my support. J.D. is kissing my ass. He wants my support. So this is a great person who I've really gotten to know. Yeah, he said some bad things about me, but that was before he knew me, and then he fell in love.
He went on, by the way, to compare it to his relationship with Kim Jong-un. So I don't know, man, with friends like that.
Yeah, it's still a wave year. I mean, I know J.D. Vance. He called me up in his anti-Trump days to plot against the president. So I'm for Ryan because I think J.D. lacks the character to be in the Senate. And I love Ryan's campaign. I wish the DNC would learn something from it. He's running the campaign farthest away from the Washington, D.C. center of Democratic gravity of anybody in the country. And it's been effective. But this is the kind of year. You know, in a bad Republican year, I think he'd win. In a year like this, I think even a box of hammers may be able to win, and we're going to test that with J.D. Vance.
Well, the thing that wraps up this whole discussion about the midterms is there are lots of forces at play here, but there are gravitational pulls.
Right.
Historically, only in 1934 and 2002 have the incumbent parties gained seats in the House. We haven't talked about the House, the Republicans need just five to take over the House, and the Senate is 50-50. It's a tough environment, and the president's approval rating at 42, the inflation, the gravitational forces are what Democrats are trying to defy. So far, they have defied gravity.
Right, and it's not close, by the way, just historically. These are worse than normal midterm gravitational forces. His unfavorable is worse. His view on the economy is worse. Inflation is worse. Everything's worse. The question is this unique to now stuff, the Republican crazy factor, Roe overturning, and maybe a surge in low turnout voters who are young, is that enough to overcome a worse than normal midterm? I just want to do one polling rant. because there's so much conventional wisdom and media attention on this generic ballot question for Congress, which party are you going to vote for? I think it's the worst question in polling. And people totally in the therapy animal, you know, experience there are obsessing on that. Since World War II through 2018, the Democrats—
And Murphy fought in World War II, by the way, but go ahead.
Yeah, that's right. We taught that Schickelgruber a lesson. The problem with that question, one is people change their opinions in the close. So in the summer, who knows what it really tells you? It's kind of a popularity question. And second, the popular vote for Congress and the results in number of seats are not directly aligned. Since World War II, it's been about a 4.25% difference, by the way, favoring the Democrats. So in recent years, it's been less that way. So it's a misleading therapy animal question that the press way overemphasizes.
Well, Mo knows this. Democrats need to be 6 to 8 points ahead to make real gains in the House because of the way we distribute ourselves geographically. Yeah. So that is true. It's also true that Democrats have, you know, have improved their position by several points over the summer.
Yeah. I mean, look, and I'm full agreement. I hate that question. But I actually think this is unlike most midterms, right? I am not belittling the importance of those gravitational pulls. And I agree with you, Mike, that they are stronger than usual. But I think the other dynamics that are unique to this cycle, the quality of the candidates that Republicans have nominated in a number of these statewide races, the continued dominance of Donald Trump in the news, and how that is impacting the party, the Dobbs decision. There are a number of other factors that are at play that put the election at play in a year that it should not, right?
Right. No, that's what's so, that's the fascinating aspect. Will they, and in the Senate races, they might. I don't think in the House, but.
We hosted here at Georgetown the chairs of the Republican Governors Association and Democratic Governors Association on back-to-back nights. And I was expecting the, you know, Doug Ducey, the chair of the RGA, to come in and be crowing. And he was confident, but he had to admit that a lot of these governors' races are much closer than a lot of people expected. And I heard Roy Cooper talking about going on offense in a lot of places in ways that I wasn't necessary. I thought they were going to be fully focused on defense.
Well, we should note that Ducey didn't get the candidate of his choice in his own state succeed him.
That's exactly right.
Kari Lake, who is a full-out election denier and Trump candidate, is neck and neck with her opponent, Katie Hobbs.
I like her new campaign slogan, though, crazy times demand a crazy governor. I think it's showing some traction in the polling right now.
Did you put that in the suggestion box over there?
I might have emailed an idea or two.
Before we move on to the mailbag, I want to talk about the president, because he caused a kerfluffle this weekend when he was on 60 Minutes talking about answering the question about whether he was going to run for re-election. Let's listen to that.
Sir, are you committed to running again, or are there certain conditions that have to be right?
Look, if I were to say to you, I'm running again, all of a sudden a whole range of things come into play that I have requirements I have to change and move and do.
In terms of election laws?
In terms of election laws. And it's much too early to make that kind of decision. I'm a great respecter of fate. And so what I'm doing is I'm doing my job. I'm going to do that job. And within the time frame that makes sense after this next election cycle here, going into next year, make a judgment of what to do.
You say that it's much too early to make that decision. I take it the decision has not been made in your own head.
Look, my intention, as I said to begin with, is that I would run again. But it's just an intention. But is it a firm decision that I run again? That remains to be seen.
Yeah, so that last part got everybody all a Twitter on Twitter.
Yeah, I'll defend it. Well, first of all, you're in the 60 Minutes demo, Ax. I'm down here in TikTok with the kids, so I didn't actually actually see it.
Yeah.
You got to tell me what's on Dumont tomorrow night. Yeah. But I feel a little sorry for
this
Biden.
This is the guy who quotes 50s and 60s television on a regular basis, but go ahead.
Right. No, exactly. And I want to go out today with some Eddie Cantor numbers. But, you know, that question.
Well, it's almost Rosh Hashanah, so Cantor would be good. But anyway, go ahead.
All right, all right. I'm going to go to a physics analogy here for our Brainiac okay. audience. That question suffers from the old physics concept of the Heisenberg uncertainty principle, because the conducting of the experiment changes the outcome. You know, it's not neutral, because you can't answer that question if you're Biden. If you say if you honestly answer it, you know, hell yeah, I'm running, then boom, you create a big news cloud and all kinds of stuff of no benefit to you right now. If you say, what are you, crazy? I'm 108. I'm not going to run. Then you've started another H-bomb in politics. So that is a question that cannot be answered by a president honestly at this point. And he danced around it, but by the nature of it, you're going to be dancing. And I thought it would, it had, let's put it this way, the question before it was about Taiwan and China, and he quoted strategic ambiguity. Well, I thought he pivoted right into more strategic ambiguity. So I'm not going to beat him up on that.
Probably people want him to show more ambiguity on Taiwan and less on this, but
I agree. I'm glad you played the first part of his answer there, Act, right?
It's important.
Because most of the media has not, because he's absolutely right. If he were to say, yes, I am running for re-election, you know, bells go off at the Federal Elections Commission saying, where's your paperwork, right? It sets off some federal legal requirements that they're not ready for yet as a campaign. So he basically said that he was by saying, it is my intention, but falling short of that trigger that requires him to start raising money and opening up campaign accounts.
Yes, I agree with everything that you said. And let me say two things. One is, I don't think anybody out there other than people like us and people in the media give a shit about whether he's announcing 2.5 years or 2.25 or whatever years ahead that he's running for president. This is an inside thing. But the reason it's an inside thing is because he's not like any other president. If he were 60, if he were 50, nobody would be doubting this, no matter what happens in the midterms. You know, Barack Obama got his ass kicked in the midterms. Bill Clinton got his ass kicked in the midterms. They both came back and got reelected, Obama by quite a margin in the Electoral College. That's not the issue. The issue is Biden turns 80 in December, and that is what occasions the questions. And honestly, that is what should be that's what he needs to reflect on as he makes his decision. And in that context, I thought when he said, I respect fate, I thought that he gave a very honest answer.
As honest as you can with that question, which you can't answer.
Right. But I mean, I think what he was saying also is, you know, I'll make the decision when I think I need to make the decision, and I'll consider all the factors. And he should consider all the factors. But I thought that way too much was made of.
Yeah, but, you know, shocker, Washington press corps massively overreacts to trivia. You know, that's the
not just
the
press corps, but
business.
The political community as well. But we're in one big incestuous pond, as it were. So, wait a second. Mo, you're being really quiet on that. Am I wrong on this age thing?
No.
I
mean, no, look, he has said from the day after his inauguration, he intends to run for re-election. I have no reason to doubt that he intends to run for re-election. I think he is planning to run for re-election. I don't think you walk away from this after chasing it for 30, 40 years. Once you get it, I don't think you walk away from it unless you have to. And I think that's the only question. Does he feel like he has to? I'm with you. I don't think poll numbers are going to scare him away. I don't think midterm results will scare him away. I think he still believes that he's the right guy for the right moment. I think he still believes that he is the only guy who can beat Donald Trump should Donald Trump be the Republican nominee again. So I think all signs point to him running for re-election. But I think when he says something like, I respect fate, he is signaling that, like, I'm not going to do something that is not right for me or for the country. And if his health, which I think is the only factor that keeps him out of the race, if his health takes a turn, if there's that reason, then he will step away. But I don't think he intends to for any other reason.
Or if he can make some, like I keep saying, his problem is the question is not political, it's actuarial. He has to make some judgment, not just about what his health is now, but what it's like
what
to be president from the age of 82 to 86.
Yeah, yeah. Right.
And that is what he has to consider. You know, he's had an amazing run this summer of stuff that I mean, it's not like he doesn't have stuff he could run on. And we don't know where the economy is going to be in 2 years. So, like I said, it's not a political decision. It's a decision about whether he feels is right at this stage in his life to do it. And that comes up everywhere in polling as well.
There's one answer to this question, and we're back to gravity. They all want to run again if they are able to, politically and physically. And of course, he'll run again if he thinks he can, in the wider interest of not just himself, but the country. The problem he'll have is that he's hit his high point. He's going to lose the appropriations process when the Republicans take the House, which is highly likely. I don't know about the Senate. And so his power to do things will be curbed, and then he might face a primary. So rocky road ahead. David's right. He had a tremendous bunch of bipartisan accomplishments this year. He hasn't gotten full credit for. But the old quit while you're ahead thing is not a dumb piece of folk wisdom.
Well, on that note about quitting while we're ahead, we take the mail
cut
back.
Cut to the music.
Yes.
All right, dear listeners, if you have a question for the Hacks, send it to us at hacksontap@gmail.com. That is hacksontap@gmail.com. If it involves tricky constitutional law, reach out to our super listener and legal expert, Mr. Nick Strelitz. I said I'd plug his name. He's a big listener. Thank you, Nick. And don't forget to subscribe to the Hacks on Tap newsletter. It's free, comes by email twice a week. Gibbs and I do it because we can't afford Axelrod, but we have a lot of fun and we talk about stuff we don't always get to on the podcast. All you got to do is go to hacksontap.bulletin.com, hacksontap.bulletin.com. Okay. Oh, by the way, go blue. One of our producers paid me a nickel to say that, some University of Michigan scam. Let's get to the questions, David. This is for you. Patrick wants to know, dear professor, if the GOP wins the House by a small majority, is it possible that the fractured GOP doesn't sufficiently get behind Kevin McCarthy as speaker and the Dems unite behind Nancy Pelosi and she gets elected speaker of a House that's still majority Republican? Wow. A lot of twists and turns in that plot, David. What do you say?
Yes. And I think it will remain a fiction. I do think that it's likely that if the House majority is narrowly Republican, that McCarthy is in jeopardy. I had this discussion with Adam Kinzinger on the Axe Files this week. In fact, this is what he said.
Here's the thing I have learned about Donald Trump. He respects people, even if he won't say it, but stick to what they believe. I guarantee he probably has a great deal of respect for Liz Cheney. He does not respect people that suck up to him. And you see that because everybody that sucks up to him at some point gets thrown out by Donald Trump. He just doesn't have respect for them. And I think that's his feeling on Kevin McCarthy. And I think, particularly if there's a narrow Republican majority, it only takes five Republicans or six Republicans to come together, deny Kevin the speaker, because they want, let's say, Jim Jordan, or they have this idea that Donald Trump can sit as speaker. Any of them can do that. And I know these Freedom Caucus members fairly well, and I know that they have no problem turning their back on him, and they will.
So there you go. I think that McCarthy could be in jeopardy with a narrow majority. Would they turn to Nancy Pelosi? First of all, I don't think Nancy Pelosi is going to be in the House next year. I think that she has done her duty, and I think she will likely. I had not inside information at all, by the way. My hypothesis is that she will step down after the election, whatever, regardless of what happens, and that to make way for new leadership. But I think Republicans will find a Republican to be the Speaker of the House if the Republicans have the House majority. Just may be a hell of a row to figure out who that person could be. But Murphy, you're a Republican. What do you think?
I think Trump's going to blame if they underperform, win, but underperform, because the expectations in the conference are we're going to get 40 seats. And when they don't, Trump's going to roast Kevin, and it's going to be a fight, and Kevin will not be the next speaker. That's my Kreskin prediction, if they underperform. If they're in the mid to high double digits, you know, 15, 20, I think he will be speaker.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting, right? Like, even the Democrats who have openly said that Pelosi should be replaced will still say how much they respect her. You don't hear a lot of Republicans walking around. Republicans
true.
In the House walking around saying, Kevin McCarthy is a great leader, just maybe not the right guy right now. Right? He doesn't seem to be engendering that. And you look at what happened to John Boehner. and how he struggled with the Freedom Caucus. You look at how Paul Ryan struggled with the Freedom Caucus. McCarthy seems every day to be getting railroaded by the MAGA caucus. And so, you know, I don't know why he'd want the job, right? But yeah. But yeah, I don't think it's certain that he gets it.
Well, Nancy has a whole nother career coming in Taiwan, too. Let's keep an eye on that.
Everything McCarthy has done for his entire tenure in the House has been aimed at becoming Speaker of the House. And, you know, it's like damn Yankees, you know. He wants to play center field for the Washington Senators or whatever, and he's willing to trade his soul to do it. And we've seen that, and we'll see what that whole fable doesn't end well. Mo, I got one for you from Joshua, who asks, given that Lindsey Graham recently proposed a 15-week national abortion ban, should Dems propose something else to counter? If so, what would it be?
I mean, look, first of all, Lindsey Graham's 15-week abortion ban was not a serious piece of legislation, right? It was something to juice up the Republican base. I think it might have backfired when you see that most of his colleagues immediately went running from it. But the other thing I'd say is Democrats already have, right? We remember back in the early days of the summer, right after the Supreme Court decision came down, House Democrats actually passed legislation in the House to codify Roe v. Wade, just didn't have enough Democratic votes in the Senate, or any Republican votes either. It didn't have enough votes to pass the Senate. So what the Democratic message is now to counter that 15-week abortion ban, and they're saying it every single day in every part of the country, elect more Democrats. That's now the Democratic message, is by electing more Democrats, we can stop things like this 15-week, this effort to run a national ban on abortion. I also think Lindsey Graham overstepped here, because he completely undercut his own party's message on this. Their whole argument all along has been, we don't want there to be a federal standard on abortion. We want to send this back to the states. And then he steps forward with a federal ban. That was not something that I think a lot of his colleagues appreciated.
I think it was too clever by half. But what he was trying to do was create a position that Republicans can say they're for, that politically is not nearly as dangerous as a total ban. You know, 15 weeks is the world standard. France is 13. I think the Nordic countries are 16. Average of democracies is 13 weeks. 13 weeks is not a hugely controversial thing like this no exception stuff, which is death. Or on the liberal side, late term abortions, which we used to win campaigns being against that back in the 90s when it kind of popped up as a national interest. So it was a political strategy. You're right. It wasn't serious legislation. It was a position he thought people could go to for political advantage, but it's a little late. A lot of them dug in too far in the primary, and I thought it was too clever by half. But that was the intent.
Well, 15 was what the Mississippi law was that was under consideration when the court threw out Roe completely. And I think I've said here before, I'm sure McConnell and McCarthy were hoping that Roberts would prevail support in his position that we should affirm Mississippi but keep Roe in place. But I think both you guys are right. I think Graham, he thought he was trying to give way a raft to Republicans who didn't want to be for a total ban. But Mo's right. It's kind of crazy when the party had been arguing for 50 years this should be a state issue. And his answer is to propose a national ban. And you're right, Murphy, that it's too cute by half. And because you were so right about that, I'm going to give you a question as well.
Oh, here we go. I'll be right about this, too.
Jim has an interesting question. Why is right track, wrong track polling significant? That's the question where voters are asked whether the country's on the right track or wrong track. It seems there are many more reasons for responding, Jim says, wrong track than the president or his party are to blame. With the turmoil in the country due to Trump crazy world, wouldn't people say wrong track thinking of democracy being in jeopardy?
Well, I think there might be people on the left who think that Trump is a wrong track driver, maybe even some people in the center. It's an important question. It doesn't ask or mention a candidate's name. It's a mood of the electorate question. And it goes, as David said, do you think things are going the right track? Or they have gotten pretty seriously off on the wrong track.
Right.
So for wrong track, you got to have a little motivation. When it's a majority right track, you know, it's morning again in America. Incumbents are very happy. Everything's fine. Reelect, reelect. When it's a majority wrong track, and the needle has been stuck there for quite a while. It used to oscillate with the economy. Now, people are wrong track. The question is how much. 60 used to be a high number. Now we can see it in the 70s all the time, which was unheard of. People want to fire politicians. And the anti-politics candidates, be it an Arnold Schwarzenegger, who I got to work for back in the early 2000s running for governor of California in an 80% wrong track environment, or a John Fetterman now in Pennsylvania, if you, regardless of ideology, seem to be not a politician and hostile to the elite political system, you tend to get a lot of interest. You also see more independent candidacy. So it's a powerful thing that sets the agenda. It doesn't rule the election, but it gives you an idea of, are the voters smiling and happy, or are they carrying Frankenstein torches and looking for the castle?
But to Mo's point, and what makes this year so interesting, is normally this these midterms are a referendum on the incumbent and the direction of the country. But if you can make the alternative unacceptable, there are going to be some number of voters who say, yeah, I don't think things are great, but these guys aren't going to make it better.
Yeah,
they're not
worse.
Even trying to make it better. They're going to make it worse.
Right.
And
right.
I think that is where a lot of Democrats are in their messaging.
Best shot they've got.
If you look at that question in the week or two after the insurrection on January 6th, right? I mean, nobody in the wake of that said the country was on the right track, but for very different reasons. And I think, you know, to the heart of the question, that is one of the challenges with that poll question, is that right now a lot of people think the country is going to hell in a handbasket, and they're blaming the other guys. And now that's not great for incumbency, clearly, but both sides are blaming the other. And so I do think that question lacks a lot of nuance, a lot of clarity. Doesn't get the clarity.
Just as an aside on this, in a highly polarized country where Democrats tend to rally behind Democrats and Republicans behind Republicans, it's interesting to look at independent voters who are cross-pressured on questions like this, and who I think 6 months ago would have tilted very strongly against Democratic candidates and now have come back. And that's why this election is more competitive than it would have been 6 months ago.
Do either of you remember when the last time that right track was net positive over wrong track?
Oh, you get little bumps like after a presidential inauguration. I don't know if Trump ever got there.
I don't know if we ever got into the 50s.
I think Reagan era for the 50s. It's tied up before.
But the point being, it has been decades since that people have felt the country's headed in the wrong direction, for decades nonstop, with maybe a few blips.
We've mastered the art of the negative argument and the argument that incentivizes our bases, and they tend to be...
Well, they're all grievance arguments on both sides,
exactly.
And it feeds the wrong track.
We've incentivized division as opposed to unity.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm going to get my jaws of life here. I'm going to pry in. All right.
Thanks for coming, everybody. Oh, sorry.
Yeah, exactly. It's true the partisans on both sides are always wrong track now, especially if they're, you know, they root for whose team is in power. But independent voters are always torn, college-educated ones, between their economic pull toward the Republican right of center and their cultural pull toward left of center. And that will determine this election, because if it's economic agenda with a wrong track, Democrats are going to get slaughtered. If it's independents pushing back on the cultural stuff they feel threatened by from the Republicans, then you will see some Democratic Senate seats not get wiped out. My money is on a typical wave election between wrong track and inflation. But we'll see. The Senate seats are where it'll be interesting.
Mo, it's great to have you. You got to come back more often. And I just want to put a little plug in for the Georgetown Institute of Politics. I'm the founder of the Institute of Politics at the University of Chicago. You came to me when you took on this assignment, and you've done such a splendid job there. It's such a wonderful program at Georgetown. And you, Murphy, have your own version of it at USC.
Well, I'm torn because I'm on the board of the University of Chicago Institute of Politics.
Which we appreciate, yes.
Where we've been trying to rein you in for a decade here, unsuccessfully. And I'm a Hoya, so I'm a big fan of what Mo's doing over there. But I am co-director of the University of Southern California's Center for the Political Future, along with Bob Schrum, the retired Democratic legendary consultant. You ought to check us out on our website and social media because we do a lot of Zoom programming. So three great institutes, one great podcast.
With one goal.
Thank you both for the kind words. And you both have been great mentors to me in this role. And frankly, before I took this role, when we all used to be partisan warriors. And, you know, it's fun having this conversation with three refugees from the political battlefield who
yes.
are now all comfortably sitting in our ivory towers of academia, surveying everything. But I appreciate
it. It's so much fun, and we're so smart when we don't have responsibility for it.
I'm still doing campaigns here, so I'm still sullied by the thing. But yes. I got one foot in it for sure.
He's a semi-refugee. He's a half podcaster, half consultant.
I'm sure you both would agree, based on your own experiences on your campuses. Yeah, I took this job in part because I felt like I had hit a wall and I was just kind of getting disgusted by my own life's work. I still believed in politics, but I didn't like how we were practicing it. And I hang out with these young people today, man. I hang out with these students and they have such a desire to do it better than I did. I tell them all the time, like, I'm not here to teach you how to do politics because people hate politics. I'm one of the guys that broke it. But, you know, I can show you why we do it the way we do it. You tell me how to do it better. And these kids are so, so optimistic.
Amen to that. I leave the IOP at the University of Chicago every day more optimistic than when I walk in because of the interaction with these young people. And we need them. The best thing we can impart, and everybody knows it now after the last 10 years, democracy is not a spectator sport. It requires investment of ourselves. So even if you're not going to be running for office or running campaigns, even if you're just a citizen, there is an obligation associated with that to be involved and to be aware and to be engaged. And these young people, really, who I interact with, who you guys interact with, they will be. Whatever they do, they're going to be involved, and that's good for the country.
I mean, I love it. I look in their young, idealistic eyes, and I tell them, now gut your opponent. You're there to win. Gentlemen, thank you so much.
All right, guys.
It was great.
Thanks for having me, guys.
All right, take care, Mo. See you later, X.
See ya.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.